The buzzard had calculated the range with care, so that the pattern of shot spread to its most deadly arc. It caught the phalanx of sailors squarely, raked the sand of the beach into a blinding white storm, and went on to tear across the surface of the quiet lagoon waters like a gale. Most of the Golden Bough's men were struck down instantly, but a few stayed on their feet, bewildered and stunned, staggering like drunkards from their wounds and from the turmoil of grapeshot and the blast of disrupted air. Cumbrae seized his claymore from the bottom of the pit, where he had buried it under a light coating of sand, and leapt to his feet. He rushed on these few survivors, the great sword gripped in both hands. He struck the head clean from the torso of the first man in his path, just as his own sailors came charging out of the gun smoke, yelling like demons and brandishing their cutlasses. They fell upon the decimated shore party and hacked them down. Even when Cumbrae bellowed, "Enough! Give quarter to those who yield!" they took no heed of this order, and swung the cutlasses until the thrown blood drops wet them to the elbows and speckled their grinning faces. Cumbrae had to lay about him with his fists and the flat of his sword. "Avast! We need men to sail the Golden Bough. Spare me a dozen, you bloody ruffians!" They gave him less than he demanded. When the carnage was over, there were only nine, trussed ankle and wrist, and lying belly down in the sand like porkers in the marketplace. "This way!" the buzzard bellowed again, and led his crew sprinting down the beach to where the longboats from the Golden Bough were drawn up. They piled into them and seized the oars. With Cumbrae roaring in the bows like a wounded animal, they pulled for the Golden Bough, hooked onto her sides, and went swarming up onto her deck with cutlass bared and pistols cocked. There help was not needed. Sambol's men had taken the Golden Bough by surprise and storm. The deck was slippery with blood, and corpses were strewn across it and huddled in the scuppers. Under the forecastle, a small band of Llewellyn's men were hanging on desperately, surrounded by Sam's gang of boarders. But when they saw the buzzard and his gang storm up onto the deck, they threw down their cutlasses. Those few who could swim raced to the ship's side and dived into the lagoon, while the others fell to their knees and pleaded for quarter. "Spare them, Mr. Bowles," Cumbrae shouted. "I need the sailors." He did not wait to see the order obeyed, but snatched a musket from the hands of the man beside him and ran to the rail. The escaping sailors were splashing their way towards the mangrove trees. He took careful aim at the head of one, whose pink scalp showed through his wet grey hair. It was a lucky shot, and the man threw up both hands and sank, leaving a pink stain on the surface. The men around Cumbrae hooted with glee and joined in the sport, calling their targets and laying wagers on their marksmanship. "Oh, give me fives in shillings on that rogue with the blonde pigtail!" They shot the swimming men like wounded ducks. Sam Bowles came grinning and bobbing to meet Cumbrae. "The ship is yours, Your Grace." "Well done, Mr. Bowles." Cumbrae gave him such a hearty blow of commendation as to knock him almost off his feet. "There'll be some hiding below decks. Winkle them out. Try to take them alive. Put a boat in the water and drag those out also." He pointed at the few survivors still splashing and swimming towards the mangroves. "I'm going down to Llewellyn's cabin to find the ship's papers. Call me when you have all the prisoners trussed up in the waist of the ship." He kicked open the locked door to Llewellyn's cabin and paused to survey the interior. It was beautifully appointed, the furniture carved and polished and the drapery of fine velvet. In the writing desk he found the keys to the iron strong box that was bolted to the deck below the comfortable bunk. As soon as he opened it, he recognised the purse he had given Llewellyn. "I am much obliged to you, Christopher. You'll not be needing this where you're going," he murmured as he slipped it into his pocket. Under it was a second purse, which he carried to the desk. He spilled the golden coins out onto the tabletop. £216, 5 shillings and 2p, he counted. "This will be the money for the running of the ship. Very parsimonious, but I'm grateful for any contribution." Then his eyes lit on a small wooden chest in the bottom of the box. He lifted it out and inspected the name carved into the lid. The Honourable Vincent Winterton. The chest was locked, but it yielded readily to the blade of his dirk. He smiled as he saw what it contained, and let a handful of coins run through his fingers. No doubt the gambling losses of the good Colonel Schroeder are in here. But he need never be tempted to wager them again. I will take care of them for him. He poured a mug of French brandy from the captain's stores and seated himself at the desk while he ran through the ship's books and documents. The logbook would make interesting reading at a later date. He set it aside. He glanced through a letter of partnership agreement with Lord Winterton, who, it seemed, owned the Golden Bough. "No longer, your lordship," he grinned. "I regret to inform you that she is all mine now." The cargo manifest was disappointing. The Golden Bough was carrying mostly cheap trade goods, knives and axes, cloth, beads and copper rings. However, there were also 500 muskets and a goodly store of black powder in her holds. "Oh, so you are going to do a spot of gun smuggling? Shame on you, my dear Christopher," he tuttered disapprovingly. "I'll have to find something better to fill her holds on the return voyage," he promised himself, and took a pull at the brandy. He went on sorting through the other documents. There was a second letter from Winterton agreeing to the Golden Bough's commission as a warship in the service of the Prester John, and a flowery letter of introduction to him signed by the Chancellor of England, the Earl of Clarendon, under the Great Seal, commending Christopher Llewellyn to the ruler of Ethiopia in the highest terms.
"Ah, that is of more value. With some small alteration to the name, even I would fall for that."
He folded it carefully and replaced the chest, the purses, the books and the documents in the strong box, and hung the key on a ribbon around his neck. While he finished the rest of the brandy, he considered the courses of action that were now open to him. This war in the Great Horn intrigued him. Soon the southeast trade winds would begin to blow across the ocean of the Indies. On their benevolent wings the Great Mogul would be sending his dhows, laden with troops and treasure, from his empire on the mainland of India, and further India, to his entrepôts on the African coast. There would also be the annual pilgrimage of the faithful of Islam, taking advantage of the same fair wind to sail up the Arabian Sea on their journey to the birthplace of the Prophet of God. Potentates and princes, ministers of state and rich merchants from every corner of the Orient. They would carry with them such riches as he could only guess at, to lay as offerings in the holy mosques and temples of Mecca and Medina. Cambry allowed himself a few minutes to dream of pigeon's blood rubies and cornflower sapphires the size of his fist, and elephant loads of silver and gold bullion. With the Gull and the Golden Bough sailing together, there ain't no black heathen prince who'll be able to deny me. I will fill my holds with the best of it. Frankie Courtney's miserly little treasure pales beside such abundance, he consoled himself. It still rankled sorely that he'd not been able to find Frankie's hiding place, and he scowled. When I sail from this lagoon, I will leave the bones of Jiri and those other lying blackamoors as signposts to mark my passing, he promised himself. Sam Bowles interrupted his thoughts by sticking his head into the cabin. "Begging your pardon, Your Grace, we've rounded up all the prisoners. It was a clean sweep. Not one of them got away." The buzzard heaved himself to his feet, glad to have a distraction from these niggling regrets. Let's see what you got for me, then." The prisoners were bound and squatting in three files in the ship's waist. 42 hardened saltwater men," said Sam proudly, "sound in wind and limb."
"None of them wounded?"
the buzzard asked incredulously. Sam answered in a whisper.
"I knew you wouldn't want to be bothered to play nursemaid to such. We held their heads underwater to help them on their way into the bosom of Jesus. For most of them it was a mercy."
"I'm amazed at your compassion, Mr. Bowles," Cumbrey grunted. "But in future spare me such details. You know I'm a man of gentle persuasion."
He put that matter out of his mind and contemplated his prisoners. Despite Sam's assurance, many had been heavily beaten. Their eyes were blackened and their lips cut and swollen. They hung their heads, and none would look at him. He walked slowly down the squatting ranks, now and then seizing a handful of hair and lifting the man's face to study it. When he reached the end of the line, he came back and addressed them jovially.
"Hear me, me bully lads. I have a berth for all of ye. Sail with me, and ye shall have a shilling a month, and a fair share of the prize money. And as sure as my name is Angus Cochrane, there'll be sackloads of gold and silver to share."
None replied, and he frowned. Are you deaf? Or has the devil got your tongues? Who will sail with Cochrane of Cumbrae?
The silence hung heavily over the deck. He strode forward and picked out one of the most intelligent-looking of his prisoners.
What's your name, lad? Davy Morgan. Will you sail with me, Davy?
Slowly the man lifted his head and stared at the buzzard.
I saw young Mr. Winterton slaughtered and the captain shot down in cold blood on the beach. I'll not sail with any murdering pirate.
Pirate! The buzzard screamed. You dare to call me a pirate, you lump of stinking offal! You were born to feed the seagulls, and that's what you shall do!
The great claymore rasped from its scabbard, and he swung it down to cleave Davy Morgan's head through the teeth as far as his shoulders. With the bloody sword in his hand, he strode down the line of prisoners.
Is there another amongst you who dare to call me pirate to my face?
No man spoke out, and at last Cumbrae rounded on Sam Bowles.
Lock them all in the golden bow's hold. Feed them on half a pint of water and a biscuit a day. Let them think about my offer more seriously. In a few days' time I'll speak to these lovelies again, and we shall see if they have better manners then.
He took Sam aside and spoke in a quieter tone.
There is still some storm damage that needs repair.
He pointed up at the rigging.
She's your ship now to sail and command. Make all good at once. I want to leave this God-forsaken anchorage as soon as I can. Do you hear me, Captain Bowles?
Sam Bowles' face lit with pleasure at the title.
Oh, you can rely on me, Your Grace.
Cumbrae strode to the entry port and slid down into one of the longboats.
Take me back to the beach of varlets.
He jumped over the side before they touched the sand and waded knee-deep to the shore where Colonel Schroeder was waiting for him.
My lord, I must speak to you,
he said, and the buzzard smiled at him engagingly.
Your discourse always gives me pleasure, sir. Come with me. We can talk while I go about my affairs.
He led the way across the beach and into the grove.
Captain Llewellyn was, Schroeder began, but the buzzard cut him off. Llewellyn was a bloody pirate. I was defending myself from his treachery.
He stopped abruptly and faced Schroeder, hauling up his sleeve to display the ridged purple scar that disfigured his shoulder.
Do you see that? That's what I got for trusting Llewellyn once before. If I had not forestalled him, his desperadoes would have fallen on us and slaughtered us where we stood. I'm sure that you understand and that you are grateful for my intervention. It could have been you going that way.
He pointed at the group of his men who were staggering up from the beach, dragging the corpses of Llewellyn and Vincent Winterton by their legs. Llewellyn's shattered head left a red drag mark through the sand. Schroeder stared aghast at the burial party. He recognized in Cumbrae's words both a warning and a threat. Beyond the first line of trees was a series of deep trenches that had been freshly dug all over the area where once Sir Francis Courtney's encampment had stood. His hut was gone, but in its place was a pit 20 feet deep, its bottom filled with seepage of brackish lagoon water. There was another extensive excavation on the site of the old spice godown. It looked as though an army of miners had been at work amongst the trees. The buzzard's men dragged the corpses to the nearest of these pits and dumped them unceremoniously into it. The bodies slid down the steep side and splashed into the puddle at the bottom.
Schroeder looked troubled and uncertain. I find it difficult to believe that Llewellyn was such a person.
But Cumbrae would not let him finish.
By God, Schroeder, do you doubt my word? What of your assurance that you wanted to throw in your lot with me? If my actions offend you, then it's better that we part now. I will give you one of the pinnaces from the Golden Bough and a crew of Llewellyn's pirates to help you make your own way back to Good Hope. You can explain your fine scruples to Governor Van der Velder. Is that more to your liking?
No, sir, it is not, said Schroeder hurriedly. You know I cannot return to Good Hope.
Well then, Colonel, are ye still with me?
Schroeder hesitated, watching the grisly labours of the burial teams. He knew that if he crossed Cumbrae, he would probably end up in the pit with Llewellyn and the sailors from the Golden Bough. He was trapped.
I am still with you,
he said at last. The buzzard nodded.
Here's my hand on it, then.
He thrust out his huge freckled fist covered with wiry ginger hair. Slowly, Schroeder reached out and took it. Cumbrae could see in his eyes the realization dawning that from now onwards he would be on the pale, and was content that he could trust Schroeder at last. By accepting and condoning the massacre of the officers and crew of the Golden Bough, he had made himself a pirate and an outlaw. He was, in every sense, the Buzzard's man.
"Come along with me, sir. Let me show you what we have done here." Cumbrae changed the subject easily, and led Schroeder past the mass grave without another glance at the pile of corpses.
"You see, I knew Francis Courtney well. We were like brothers. I am still certain that his fortune is hidden hereabouts. He has what he took from the Standfastigheid, and that from the Heilige Nacht. By the blood of all the saints, there must be £20,000 buried somewhere under these sands."
At that they came to the long, deep trench, where 40 of Cumbrae's men were already back at work with spades. Amongst them were the 3 black seamen he had bought on the slave block at Good Hope.
"Jiri!"
the buzzard bellowed.
"Matisi! Kimati!"
The slaves jumped, threw down their spades, and scrambled out of the ditch in trepidation to face their master.
"Look at these great beauties, sir. I paid 500 florins for each. It was the worst bargain I ever struck. Here before your eyes, you have living proof that there are only 3 things a blackamoor can do well. He can prevaricate, thieve, and swive."
The buzzard let fly a guffaw.
"Isn't that the truth, Jiri?"
"Yes, Lodi," Jiri grinned and agreed. "In God's own truth."
The buzzard stopped laughing as suddenly as he'd begun.
"What do you know about God, you heathen?"
he roared, and with a mighty swing of his fist he knocked Jiri back into the ditch.
"Get back to work, all 3 of you!"